In the 1970s,
two hippies met. They went to festival after festival. In their own words, they said they'd done everything they possibly could to find some peace, some satisfaction, some purpose in their lives. They married, and then, by the circumstances that sometimes occur, they found themselves listening to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And it made a radical change in their lives. They were now new people, they said. They said that we have got a different purpose now. We must make this gospel known. And so they used their musical talents to write what I suppose we might describe today as worship songs, modern hymns, I suppose. Their names were Keith and Melody Green. One day, sitting at a piano, Melody had written the first two verses of There Is a Redeemer. And she asked Keith for his comments. He sat next to her on the piano stool and said, "It needs another verse. It needs an ending." And so she gradually put together the last verse of the hymn that we've just sung. "When I stand in glory, I will see his face. There I'll serve my King forever in that holy place." 5 years elapsed, and they were very much involved in Christian ministry. They set up an organisation, and Keith was often off in different places of the United States preaching the gospel. One day, Melody and one of her children waved goodbye to Keith and their two other children, along with some friends and their six children. The small plane they owned to take Keith from one preaching engagement to another took off. It wasn't long before the phone rang, and the voice at the other end of the phone said to Melody, "Our plane's gone down. I'm going to call an ambulance. But I want to tell Keith first. Will you let him know?" Melody says, "Instinctively, I said, sure. Sure." It wasn't a happy ending. All of those passengers, along with the pilot, were killed. Life is like that sometimes, isn't it? What did Melody draw her strength from? That last verse, written by her husband just 4 or 5 years previously. "When I stand in glory, I'll see him face to face." It was that assurance that there was that rest at the end of life in God's presence, in his glory, that sustained her and the small child that was too young to go on the flight. Bear that in mind, because of course the heading we have today, "There Is a Redeemer." They got their words, they say, from the passage in Job, but of course it would apply to us this evening. In all the trials and tribulations of life, many of us here would know that there is a Redeemer, there is an end. There may be tragedy, but the end really beyond death is happy ending. Let's just try and reset the scene. Muriel told us, this is number 3 of 4. I think Tim made the same comment. We need to refresh our memories. Life is full of disappointments, difficulties. Ruth and Naomi have returned now from Moab. That was Ruth's home country. The one that Naomi adopted for a short period of time, 10 years or so, during a period of famine back in their own country of Israel and Bethlehem. They've gone back. But it's a difficult life we seem to draw from those passages. They're living from mouth to mouth, hand to hand. Ruth is scavenging, really, in a sense, in the fields of the barley harvest, picking up grain where she can. And the future for them seems dark and dismal. Is there a future? Is there hope? And our passage begins by suggesting that Naomi is concerned for a home, for rest. A difficult word to translate. She says, I'm looking for a rest for you. I want you to know there is rest. There can be, as it were, some degree of contentment, of satisfaction. Their lives now are difficult. The stress, the strain. But in a home, in rest, there can be that situation, can there not, where there's a sense of security, a sense of comfort. There's a roof over our heads. We can eat together. We can live together. We can enjoy life together. That's what Naomi's concerned with. If we go back to chapter 1, she even tells Ruth alongside, go back to your own country. There you will find rest. But as we discovered, of course, Ruth says, no, I'm going to go with you. What Ruth needs, of course, is a husband. What she needs is a husband. That's what Naomi suggested she might find if she went back to Moab. There you'll find a husband. But now, of course, she needs to find a husband in Bethlehem. And so with our first heading, we discover that Naomi comes up with a plan. She has a plan. It's good to have a plan. It's good to know what we're doing. It's good to have a purpose. And Naomi comes up with a plan. She's discovered, of course, that Ruth's been gleaning in a field of Boaz. He's a near relative. And she sees, I can bring these two people together. What I need then is a plan. It's a bit of a risky plan she comes up with. Not one I would recommend to any young lady that's looking for a husband, necessarily. The plan is quite simple, really, but very risky. She invites Ruth to have a bath, put on some perfume, and put on her best dress. One commentator suggests it could be the equivalent of the little black dress of the day. I don't know. And then she's going to go to the threshing floor. The harvest has come to the end. They've gathered it in, and now they're threshing the barley, the corn, separating the wheat from the chaff. And it's come to the end of that, it would seem, as well. And now all is safely gathered in, and there's going to be a party. So she invites Ruth to go, to make herself hidden for a while, and then when Boaz has had enough to drink and he's sleeping heavily, she's going to lay at his feet. A risk, a risk. What was the purpose? Well, it's not clear, is it? The risk is there. She's a Moabite. We'll come back to that issue a bit later on this evening. There's the risk, of course, that she could be sexually abused by the labourers. Boaz had previously warned the labourers not to touch her. Don't you lay a hand on her, he told them. And Boaz, of course, could get the wrong impression completely. Why should someone sleep at his feet? What's she there for? And, of course, Boaz might not be interested in marrying Ruth. There was a risk involved. But at times, of course, we need to take a risk, don't we? We need to take risks. Are we prepared to take risks? In the first two sermons we heard on this passage, we heard about God's sovereignty. God is working his purpose out. God is in control, and that's clear. Yes, God is sovereign. God is working his purposes out. But does that mean that we just sit down on our hands and let things happen? Is that all part of God's sovereignty? Or have we a role to play in that? Does he use us as his implements to actually achieve his sovereign plans? I think that's the case, isn't it? There are times when we have to act, and sometimes acting takes a risk. There's risk involved. We can see that, I think, throughout the whole of Scripture and throughout the history of the church. There are risks. We have a plan, but sometimes there's a risk. People often say, when I get to heaven, I'm going to ask so-and-so about so-and-so. Well, whether that's theologically possible, I'm not to debate this evening. But if I get there, I think I might ask Paul what it was that Aquila and Priscilla did that he was able to say they risked their lives for me. What was it they did? What was it Epaphras did that Paul was able to write? He risked his life. He laid his neck on the block for you Colossian Christians and for me. He took a risk. I can remember a preacher when I was quite small really coming and speaking on Peter walking on the water. And the point he made, or one of the points he made, of course Peter did get out the boat. He took a risk. And I think there are times perhaps when we need to get out the boat. There may be risks, we might not see the end, but we need to take that risk, don't we? We need to take that risk. Church history shows us that. The reformers took risks when they spoke out against false doctrines. Bible translators took risks when they thought they need to translate the language of the Bible into the vernacular of the day against the wishes of the church authorities. Missionaries take risks. Church pastors take risks. But shouldn't we, perhaps, if I can describe us as ordinary Christians, and I don't want to play that down too much, but shouldn't we take risks? We need to be people that speak out, perhaps, at some of the injustices that we witness, some of the practices that perhaps we observe in our workplaces. We need to be Christians that take that risk, not knowing perhaps what the consequences might be. And we take risks, don't we? Or we should take risks to make this gospel known. To make this gospel known. So Ruth takes her bath, she sprays herself with perfume, puts on her best dress, and she now makes her way up a hill, it would seem, to the place where Boaz and his men are working, enjoying a good time, having a party. So we come to our second point. Ruth, of course, is persuaded to go along with this plan. The risk was high, but she's prepared to go along with it. They're having a party. Now it's late, and they're going to sleep. Boaz makes his way towards the end of the barn, if I can describe it thus. Near to the grain, he's going to keep watch over that overnight. He doesn't want people coming to steal it. Ruth made herself scarce, but now that Boaz is asleep and the fellow workers are asleep, she now makes her way to where he's asleep and lies at his feet. The risk is there, but that's what she was told to do, and that's what she does. She uncovers his feet. And when they get cold, he wakes up and he asks, "Who are you? Who are you?" Ruth's response is perhaps somewhat strange. First, she declares herself to be a servant. She acknowledges that she's got no rights at all, really. She has no status in this situation. She's just a humble servant. And then she makes an even stranger request. Spread the corners of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family. It's not the sort of thing you would normally expect from a couple on a first date. But that's the situation here. Let's first just unpack this idea of a redeemer, a guardian redeemer. We have to take our minds back, and we were in Leviticus this morning, surprisingly. We can go back to Leviticus and Deuteronomy again this evening and remind ourselves that this was a process that God had put in to ensure that those people in difficulties had support. And the idea was that a redeemer, a close family member, would come and support someone who was bereaved, who'd lost their husband. Invariably, the brother-in-law would intervene and marry his sister-in-law. That lies behind it. We can unpack it in greater detail at a different time. That was the principle. But of course, here we don't think that they were brother-in-law or sister-in-law. But Ruth is working on that principle explained to her by Naomi a few days earlier. Boaz is one of our near redeemers, one of our close relatives. He ought to be the person that steps in and sorts us out in our time of difficulty, time of trouble, in all our need. We are in great need. There's the first part. Spread the corner of your garment over me. Variously translated. And it's difficult to understand exactly what this is about. There's only one other reference in the Old Testament to this, and it comes much later in the chronology of the Old Testament. So reading back is sometimes dangerous, but perhaps here that's our only hope to do that. The prophet Ezekiel is speaking to God's people. He's reminding them of all their failures, of all the ways in which they've let God down, in all the ways that they've gone against his purposes and his will for them. But he hasn't forgotten them. He's going to enter into a new covenant with them. And so in Ezekiel's words, it says, "Later I passed by, and when I looked at you, I saw that you were old enough for love. I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your naked body. I gave you a solemn oath and you entered into a new covenant with you, declares the sovereign Lord. You became mine." Are we looking at some sort of custom and practice that had continued on from the days of Ruth and before, perhaps, that there was this way in which someone put their garment over somebody as a sign that they wanted to marry them, that they were going to make them their wife? And we've just got slight reversal here. Ruth is looking for marriage, I think. She wants Boaz to marry her. "I want you to be the one to whom I can pledge my faithfulness. I want you to make a marriage covenant with me," says Ruth. How does Boaz then respond to this rather strange sort of invitation of marriage, this marriage proposal? How would you respond to such a situation? Well, we come to our third point, and we find that here Boaz makes a promise. "Lord, bless you, my daughter," he replied. "This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All the people of my town know that you are a woman of noble character. Although it is true that I'm a guardian redeemer of our family, there is another who is more closely related than I. Here Boaz makes a promise. He's going to respond positively to Ruth's invitation of marriage. He recognizes perhaps something of God's hand in this, I don't know. And of course we notice already that he's now describing her as my daughter. A term of affection perhaps. He no longer sees her as the servant that he spoke of in a previous chapter. Now he sees her as a daughter. Perhaps because of the age gap between Boaz and Ruth, he speaks of her now as his daughter. And perhaps that's the reason in the past he's not taken action because of the age gap. But now she's come with him, he's happy to take action. But what we see here, of course, is rather interesting. Because back in chapter 2, Boaz prays for Ruth. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Boaz is praying for Ruth's future. He's praying that she might be blessed by God, that he might take care for her, that he might intervene into her life, that he might be her refuge and strength. All of a sudden, Boaz becomes the answer to his own prayer. He's the one that God is going to use now to actually fulfill his prayer. Sometimes, of course, we are the answers to our own prayers. We often pray, don't we, in a similar vein, perhaps, that God might do something, hoping that someone else might do it. I can remember being in a prayer meeting on a Sunday evening, week after week, and someone would pray the very same prayer, almost word by word. In fact, he could have written it for us and we could have prayed it in his absence. But he never answered his own prayer, really. And what he prayed for never really came to fruition. And as I look back at that now, 50 more or more years, I just recognise if only he had done what he prayed for, the outcome might have been different. I'm not questioning God's sovereignty there. I'm just saying sometimes we have to respond to our own prayer. And Boaz here was the person to respond. In the same way that that particular person could have responded to his own prayer and the outcome might have been extremely different. We need a bit of an excursion here. Because we need to remind ourselves, of course, that Ruth was a Moabite. And Boaz seems here quite happy now to marry a Moabite. But of course, back in the days of Moses, he'd forbidden this. He made it abundantly clear that no Moabite should ever get anywhere near the promised land. They weren't to make their way anywhere near the sanctuary. They were excluded, as were many other nations. But Moses, under God's guidance, prohibited the Moabites more than anybody else because of their behavior, their idol worship, the way that they had disregarded God's principles, God's rules. They were the worst of the worst. And so God says, I don't want them anywhere near you. I don't want them contaminating you. I don't want you getting involved with them. And the best thing you can do is keep them beyond your borders. And don't you dare go anywhere near them. We touched on that issue in the first of our sermons here when we thought about Elimelech and Naomi going to Moab. So is in fact Boaz here now going against God's principles in saying that he'll do everything that he can to make sure he marries Ruth? That would seem to be an issue. Prohibition. Is he prohibited to do that? I don't know. I think the answer's no. Why did God make it abundantly clear they weren't to mix with the Moabites? It was because of who they worshipped. The many gods of their days, the idol worship. But of course now the text is telling us something different. Ruth, of course, is now saying and making it abundantly clear, your God is my God. Your people are my people. And the way that she's reacted in the previous chapters, we can see that she's now a follower of Yahweh. She's now worshipping the same God. And I think that prohibition is now lifted. And they can marry. There's a principle, I think, there for us, is there not? In our own situation today, we need to make sure, of course, that when we enter into a marriage contract, we're entering into a contract with like minds, with someone who worships the same God as we worship, who has the same principles, same purposes as we have. Interestingly, not that long ago, someone published a book on marriage. And the title, at first reading, is somewhat strange. It says, Married with God. Married with God. And the thoughts of the writer, Christopher Ashe, is that we are married to God. And we need to recognize that. And we all perhaps have seen something of the dangers when that principle is put to one side. We need to be people for whom God is at the very center of our lives. And we need to marry someone who holds that same principle so that we can in fact be married with God. I look back and see some of the issues that have occurred in my own experience and lifetime where people have ignored that principle. And they haven't, as it were, been discerning enough to make the right choices, and they've made some catastrophic ones. But here Boaz is convinced that they're now on the same hymn sheet, as it were, worshipping the same God. She's taken refuge under God's wings, and it's right that he should now marry her. He's got a job to do. He's got to now go and talk to the other person who he declares as being a nearer redeemer. That's next week. If you don't know the ending, I'm sure you do, but you'll find that out next week. To ensure propriety, Ruth stays until it's daylight and she then makes her way home. But before she leaves, Boaz demonstrates his generosity. He's shown his generosity throughout. She'd put on a dress, and for warmth she'd put on a shawl. And now Boaz is asking her to, as it were, open up her shawl, and he's going to put into it some grain. 6 measures. Ruth, of course, is a small book. And it's interesting that I think some of the commentators felt they had to get their advance and their royalties in advance, as it were. And they had to make the book longer than it could be. And one commentator goes into a page and a half on what these measures might be. At the end of which, he says, I don't know. And then he makes the statement he could have made 20 sentences earlier. He was generous. I think it's just a simple situation, isn't it? Here she is with this shawl, as it were, being held here as a basket. And he goes, 1, 2, 3, 4. Can we get one more? Yeah, 5, 6. It's a lot. It's as much as she could carry home, perhaps. As much as she could carry home. Here is someone who is generous. Perhaps there's a lesson for us to learn. We need to be people who are generous. Not stingy. Not just giving enough, perhaps. But like Boaz, we might say, just another one. Just another one. This morning mention was made of the food bank. We are one of the more generous churches, but that doesn't mean to say that we can stop giving. We are generous. We make that point many times when I go there. But we don't sit back and think, well, we've outshone many of the other churches in Cheltenham. That's not the purpose, is it? It's not a league table. And perhaps I'm remiss in even making the comment. But we can be generous. But in making that statement, it also enables me to make another statement. They don't want any more pasta. So when harvest comes, don't bring pasta. If there was a butter mountain previously in France, there's a pasta mountain in Elam. So there it is. But we are generous. But that doesn't mean we can stop giving, does it? We are people who rely upon the generosity of God. I must move on. So we come to the last of the points. Naomi is pleased. Naomi is pleased. Her plan seems to have worked. Boaz is going to go and speak in the morning to the nearer Redeemer. He's going to see what he can do. And you'll find that answer next week, if you don't know the ending already. But what's our takeaway point this evening? What's our takeaway point this evening? We have a Redeemer. Jesus, God's own Son. That's our Redeemer. What was Naomi looking for? What did she want, as it were, as a gift to Ruth? It was rest, contentment, peace, a sense of being able to cope with life in all its difficulties, in all its ups and its downs. Where did Melody Green find her comfort? In her Redeemer. The tragic situations that existed there, the trauma of that experience. But she can testify in a little book, I knew there was a Redeemer, and in him I had hope. And she knew that alongside her husband, she would one day stand in that eternal rest of heaven and be able to say, I'm serving my King now, here in heaven, as I served him on earth. What did Jesus say to the people of his own day? Knowing the struggles that they had and the difficulties that they experienced, the ups and downs of their lives, the precious, come unto me, all you who labour and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Where were Melody Green and Keith Green trying to find their rest in their early days? In the hippie culture of the United States. One festival after another. They don't know who it was that took the risk of sharing the faith of Jesus Christ with them. But he did at a festival. And their lives were changed. Their lives were changed. Where are we going to find rest this evening? As Christians, as non-Christians perhaps. Not in the festivals of this world. Not in what this world has to offer. But in Jesus Christ. The great Redeemer. The one who was to be that great, 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 great grandson of Ruth and Boaz. The baby born in Bethlehem. The man that died upon a cross. He's the one that promises rest. He's the one who says there's even eternal rest. At the end of this life, he offers rest. When the people of Israel were nearing the promised land, Moses spoke about it being a place of rest. A place of rest. But it never was a place of rest because the people were disobedient. They never turned to God in all faith and repentance. And it's interesting to note that the writer to the Hebrews reminds us, for those who turn their backs on God, for them there is no eternal rest. They forfeit it. And as we thought this morning, as we gathered around the communion table, there is a warning there. Eternal rest comes at the end of the rest that we and contentment we experience in this life. But for those who reject the God of heaven and his Son, there is no rest. There is no rest. Naomi wanted rest for her daughter-in-law. Surely it would be for us our hope that all have rest. And therefore we must take those risks. We must put ourselves on the front line. And when it says we pray perhaps in September for the extension of God's kingdom, God in his sovereignty will want to use us and will ask us to take the risks so that people might find the rest that we enjoy and the rest that we will enjoy. But only, of course, if they have the assurance of knowing Christ. Only if we have the assurance of knowing Christ. And that's the theme of our final hymn. It reminds us in that last verse of rest, of rest. Interestingly, of course, Boaz did all he could. He was not going to rest until he achieved his objective.